Welcome to the Toffee Blues, your source for all things Everton, and welcome to another show where I am joined by Terry, Thomas, and a warm welcome to Mike Richards as well from the Unholy Trinity podcast. How are you, lads?
Good, mate, thank you.
Yeah, good, mate.
Happy back.
Yeah, don't ask three people, are they all right at the same time? Pick the name. We all wanted to go there.
No, I'm just envisaging myself walking into a pub or something and like giving everyone a wave and just like, he's all right.
Oh, what's a pub, mate? I don't remember them.
I'm going to have to build one in my room if it carries on like this.
Yeah, tell me about it. I'm good. How are you, boys? He's okay. I'll go with Thomas first. How are you, Thomas? And we need a bit of structure.
Someone's got to do it.
Obviously, I've never been in a pub in my life. Got no idea what that experience would be like, but yeah.
Right, back to you, James.
Yeah, there you go. We've got a bit of structure now. We'll get on to Mike then. How are you, mate? Like, good to have you back on the show.
Sorry, Mike, I didn't even ask you.
Don't worry, mate. Don't worry. Mate.
This is why I was in charge in the first place.
I know, yeah.
the structure's gone already, hasn't it? It's out the window already after 2 minutes. But no, good, mate. Yeah, good. Just ticking over, keeping busy and looking forward in a way of the Blues coming back in some kind of fashion in about 10 days' time.
Well, it's not long to go. 12 days it is till we're back in action. So, you know, it's not all bad. Of course, but then you realise who we're playing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or where we're playing it. We don't know yet.
We still don't even know that, do we? So, obviously, that's for another day. We'll get straight into the action on this show. We've got a lot of things to get through. We'll be starting off with our manager review segment today, which will focus on the 16-month tenure of Ronald Koeman, followed by a debate around the rumour possibility of us going back in for Kurt Zouma in the next window. Then we've got our middle bit. We'll keep that sort of random off-topic discussion where we'll, again, keep the focus on films. Then we've got a player performance review for the current season. And finally, we'll look ahead to next season with a brief discussion about the big news today that Everton have a new shirt sponsor for next season. So stay tuned for that later on throughout the show. And as always, we'll round it off with a quiz. We are going to be looking back over the performance of Ronald Koeman as Everton manager from June 2016 to that fateful day in October 2017 after we got beat 5-2 off Arsenal. So we'll start at the beginning when he was appointed manager in the summer of 2016. Less than 6 months into Farhad Moshiri's period of ownership. Despite the previous season being disappointing, I think there was a lot of optimism for the future and speculation was rife as to who would succeed Roberto Martinez as we went into the June. Michael, start with you on this, on your return. How did you feel when Koeman was announced as manager? Was he the man you wanted, Mike?
Very much like Marco Silva, obviously, after. He was the man that was much touted. There was a little bit of backwards and forwards with Southampton. I remember a lot of their fans saying at the time he wouldn't leave them for us, thinking they were on some kind of pedestal. I don't know why. But yeah, you saw with a lot of managers, you do sometimes get carried away with how they were as a player. Ronald Koeman was a world-class player, make no mistake about it. So when you hear that name being linked with the club, there was initial excitement. And when he was announced, yeah, there was definitely optimism there that we could kick on and he could do something with obviously the money of Moshiri, which had come in 6 months prior. So we thought, yeah, we could kick on and hopefully he could start getting us up to the upper echelons of the Premier League.
Certainly, and of course, when he did come in, he took Southampton to sixth, I think, the previous season. So obviously, that was where we were aiming for on a short to medium term basis. How confident were you that Koeman could obviously turn around a squad that was underperforming under Roberto Martinez?
I think, like any manager, you've always got to give them that time. I find myself to be fairly patient when it comes to Everton managers, unlike some. And again, you understand why that is, but I always thought, let's give him a little bit of time. You know, it's the first time really we've come into any kind of significant money. Let's not waste it. Obviously, we know what happened after that. But yeah, I think he would be able to do something and build a side. Obviously, from his managerial past, he hadn't really done a great deal in terms of his managerial career. Hadn't really proven anything, to be honest. But even so, you do get sucked in, as I said before, by the naming of who the man was. And I thought, given a bit of time, we could kick on and definitely start to push up and finish start to finish higher in that sort of top six of the Premier League table.
Yeah, obviously we'll move on to you now, Thomas. When he did come in, obviously the start was really good, wasn't it? You know, we I think we won the first five out of six games. We drew with Spurs and then won five in a row, which was obviously got everyone's tongues wagging a little bit. What did you think when we got off to that start early on in the season?
Obviously, I was immediately quite impressed. You know, he'd come from Southampton, which it also traditionally had a bit of a squad. They tend to be a bit of a southern team, obviously, basically Liverpool's B team. And he came to Everton, and obviously he had that trio of Lukaku, Barkley and Delafeu, which is now, we look back at it, had a lot of promise, and some people are disappointed it's not there anymore. But obviously, I think the team he inherited was already quite strong. Obviously, Gareth Barry was getting on a bit, but then in terms of that front three, he kind of inherited a front three that was end up there, you know, as one of the best in the league. And obviously, Delafeu and Lukaku had that link up, that partnership where they had like the most assists and goals. I can't remember what the exact record was, but it was one of the highest in the league. So when we got off to that start, you know, it was definitely exciting and promising things to come. But obviously, Koeman's kind of downfall came as soon as he lost Lukaku, really, and never really had a plan B. But the definite start was, you know, it was hopeful at the start, and kind of what we'd seen at Southampton in glimpses, just maybe not over a consistent period.
Obviously, we will get on to what happened after Lukaku left. But for the duration of that season, you know, we started off very well, and then we had a bit of a blip, didn't we? I mean, what did you think when, obviously, we had a really poor spell where I think we lost to Southampton, which obviously there was a lot made of that, and we got beat 5-0 off Chelsea, and then it was a pretty dreary spell, if I remember rightly, in the November, where, and then Koeman obviously put up his red Christmas tree, and that just sent everyone round the bend as well. So it was a bit of a weird time. By this point, we were only like 3 months into the season, his first season, and people were starting to question it. Did anyone start to have reservations? I'll ask that to the 3 years. Did any of us think that it was a bit, it was a bad appointment at this stage, or were people still going to give him time?
No, I think with any managerial appointment, you can't make that call that early into a tenure. Like, obviously, you know, we'll come on to when he did move on and the reasons for that and what we think of that. But even with Marco Silva, you know, last season, before they had the turnaround after they beat, you know, the long break in the second half of the season, I don't think you can sack a manager unless you look like you're going to go down. I don't think you can sack a manager in his first season. There's too much that isn't, like, you know, even, you know, the cement's not dry or anything they're trying to build yet. So no, I didn't have any issues with Koeman at this point.
Well, certainly, I think, and then obviously we go on a bit of a better run. We beat Arsenal in the December, and the Christmas period, which is pretty rare for Everton, was actually pretty decent, say for a derby defeat. And so obviously we go into the January, and the form from sort of January to March was very, very impressive, if I remember rightly. We were beating, granted, a lot of mid-table teams, but every side that you'd expect us to finish above, we were beating. And obviously Lukaku was probably in the best form. Just touch on one game in particular before we get to the next season. We have to remember the 6-3 against Bournemouth. Was anyone at that game?
Yeah, but it was one of those games where, when you think about the Koeman era, if you like, that's one of the games that you look back on, obviously, really fondly. And it was a crazy game. So it reminded me a little bit of the Blackpool game, obviously, years earlier.
I was at both of them.
Yeah, similar kind of game, just backwards and forwards. But you had obviously Lukaku banging in 4 goals. Ross Barkley obviously playing well. And it was just one of those games where, you know, a bit like a basketball game, and that was one of the ones that really stands out. But like you say, at that time, you know, we were beating teams that we should be beating, which is always, you know, we always look back on seasons and say we should have picked up points at X, Y, and Z and didn't do. But we started to do that, and obviously we had a decent spell, like you say, in that part of the season.
Beat Man City as well.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that's the one that obviously sticks out with the Tom Davis goal and obviously Luchman's goal, etc. But, you know, there was a few highlights in that first season. Obviously, with us finishing, you know, in the European places, you then think, listen, we can kick on here. We've got a good young side, some real quality. But then, obviously, the transfer window, which obviously I'm sure we're going to come on to, happens and things start to change.
Okay, well, we'll move on to that sort of issue with what happens and when the sort of winds of change started blowing, if you like. Obviously, we started to bring in players first. Jordan Pickford and Davy Klassen were the first two to come in. What was the general feeling, do you think? We'll go to you here, Thomas. What did you think, like, when Pickford and Klassen was announced? Like, those first two signings?
I was quite impressed, to be fair, because obviously Pickford had had a decent season with Sunderland, even though Sunderland were disastrous that year. But his name was, you know, amongst, you know, the kind of the top clubs in the league. Everyone was looking for a young English goalkeeper. So I was impressed that we managed to get him. And then obviously David Klassen had just come off that Europa League run with Ajax, where they lost in the final to Manchester United. So it seemed at first we were picking up players who we might not have been expected to. Definitely the first couple where we've seen names, you know, in the past where they've been linked with us, and also like people, you know, like your Chelsea's and your Arsenal's, people like that, and just go somewhere else and they don't come to us. So it almost seemed like a bit of a change of tune when we started bringing in players who would, because obviously you always get the links where it's, you know, Leicester, West Ham and Everton, you know, we all get linked to the same players. It doesn't really matter. But those first couple of transfers, we were signing players who were linked to us, but also, you know, clubs higher in the table, which was surprising, probably definitely a change of tune from what we've seen in the past.
I think the big one, I think the one that everyone was sort of gritting their teeth over and we were sort of biting our nails. I think I remember Sandro was linked with Real Madrid at one point, which is insane when you think about it now. But obviously, we ended up getting Sandro. He was one of the next signings after that. What did everyone think about Sandro? Terry, what did you think?
I think the same then as I think now. It was, you know, you can't blame the club for going for that. It seemed like, you know, a no-brainer. Like, there was a lot of ills in this summer, a lot of poor deals made, a lot of bad investments, but I don't think this was one. Okay, they did give him wages that were too high. You know, the club were played like a fiddle by his agents, you know, these Real Madrid
and
Atletico Madrid as well were linked with him and what have you. But at 20, whatever he was old then, 20 years old, was he at the time? He's a young player.
He wasn't old.
Yeah, he was a young player who just scored, you know, 14, 15 goals in La Liga. And he has like a £5 million release clause. It just was an absolute no-brainer. You know, like, you've got to take a chance on that player and, you know, he could come good. If we hadn't have given the wages that we give him, then it wouldn't be a big deal. You know, we'd just move him on. But it showed the naivety which haunted us for the whole window and is still haunting us now, that we were just throwing money everywhere. I don't blame the club for going after Sandro. It didn't work. But
it's the wages we've been saddled with. Is that the issue with the deal?
I do blame the club for making it impossible to move him on, because if he hadn't have been given them wages, I still think we would have got him, because let's be honest, Atletico and Real probably weren't going to go in for them, but we fell for it, didn't we?
That's it, yeah. I mean, I think that's where what I was actually going to move on to next is, obviously this is a Ronald Koeman review, but what part did Steve Walsh have to play in Koeman's tenure and the sort of signings that we brought in? Do you think there was a bit of like button heads maybe there, like players coming in that one didn't want, and did that kind of undermine the transfer window?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I personally think that of all the villains of this piece, I think Koeman is the most innocent. Now, Koeman obviously was, you know, he had some hands in it, but he's the first team coach. He's the one who's got to put the players on the pitch and make a team out of them. And our transfer business was the most scattergun, unjoined up mess you'll ever see. We're still paying for it now. You know, how can you blame Koeman when his top scorer, one of the league's most effective strikers for the past several years, leaves, and then he's what do you go and buy him? Like, he gets
Sandro. You
know, yeah, he gets a kid, a gamble. You know, that's fine. Get him and someone else. Fair
enough. An old Rooney.
Yeah, and a washed up Rooney, a kid who you took a gamble on, and a loads of midfielders who all play in the same position. It was just, it was a nightmare.
I think
Yeah.
Now, I mean, this may come to be almost poetic, given what we know now and our general opinion on this player. Terry, I'll reserve this for you especially. For me, the moment when I realised we were gonna we'd lost the plot was when we bought Gylfi Sigurdsson for $45 million, knowing that we already had bought Rooney and Klaassen. That was the point where I thought, we haven't got a clue what we're doing here. We've lost the plot. I'm not sure if you second that, Terry.
No, not at the time. I was a big fan of Sigurdsson. I would have been fine with Sigurdsson and Klaassen. I think you could have accommodated the two of them. But you couldn't obviously accommodate, you know, Rooney as well. You couldn't accommodate, you know, Vlasic as well. You know, like, all these players who play in like the sort of number 10 attacking midfielder position. I felt at the time that Sigurdsson was a good player and he was a good buy. I don't think anyone thought he was value for money, the money that we were spending. But I think everyone was just excited to be buying players. We'd spent that long without spending any proper money that the second we've got it, we start buying, you know, we're just buying like attack right centre. It's intoxicating. Everyone was pleased. But then when it came to putting on the pitch, you saw the first game of the next season. He had Klaassen on the right, Sigurdsson on the left, and Rooney behind the striker in a 4-2-3-1.
Calvert-Lewin at wing back.
Yeah, when the players got on the pitch, we had all these like sort of attacking midfielders, but absolutely no pace in the whole team. I think at one point they said the fastest player was Jagielka, which tells you everything. I'm sure
this is a Jagielka who just turned 35.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, Koeman, I don't think was a good fit for an Everton manager, you know, long term, you know, big picture wise rather. But I do think the bigger story is how let down he was by the transfer business. He's the coach. He doesn't sign off on the players. I think there was about three or four people who were signing off on players that summer, and I think Koeman was the most high profile victim of that, because what else could he have done if you've got no strikers anymore but you've got five midfielders in the same position?
I just thought it was insane. What we'll do with this then, we'll just run through all the signings that summer, and who do you think actually signed these off? I'll let you all jump in on this. We've got Pickford and Klaassen. I reckon those guys were players who, I think Klaassen was definitely a Koeman pick.
Yeah, I'd say Klaassen for Koeman.
Yeah, I'd say Pickford was more of a Walsh one.
Pickford was a Bill Kenwright one. Bill Kenwright signed up on Jordan Pickford 100%. That's definitely a Bill Kenwright.
Now bringing Rooney back like when he was clearly over the hills, definitely a Kenwright signing.
Rooney is the most nailed on Kenwright one of in history, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. Sandro, that seems like Steve Walsh thinking he's pulling off another Riyad Mahrez, and then it's Sandro.
Well, there was pictures of Walsh watching him, wasn't there? At a Sevilla match when Malaga were away to them, and pictures were circulated of him watching a Malaga player, and obviously it turned out to be Sandro, so I'm going to go with Steve Walsh for him.
Yeah, it's definitely one of them, and I think it was fitting that he went to the Sevilla game as well, because he was watching Sandro and going, tell you what, we should sign him and loan him there in 6 months' time.
I'm going to go with Gylfi Sigurdsson would be Mascheri.
Yeah, that'll definitely be, yeah. Definitely, throw big bucks at anything, literally. Michael Keane will be Walsh, yeah.
Walsh, definitely, yeah.
And obviously, I think because of the Southampton connection, it has to be Koeman, who unfortunately saddled us with Cuco Martina.
that's got to go down as one of the most. I mean, he was versatile, obviously. He ended up playing left back, but I mean, he was never a good footballer.
He's only versatile because he's equally crap in every position.
Yeah, he just plugged gaps. He was never a good footballer. I don't really get what we were doing that whole time with him. But yeah. He's still here. I don't know why we're talking about him like he's left. He's still under contract at the club.
It's always worrying when you sign a player and the opposition, the team that they're signing him from, their supporters are on Twitter. Like, you know, when you buy a player from abroad and you just see like... And they're all like got crying, laughing face emojis. Well, we didn't need any translation when Southampton were all their heads off that we bought Cuco Martin, and he was like their third choice right back.
Yeah, I think I remember, like, that's kind of why I was so depressed on the live deadline day show last year when we got a Iwobi for 35 million and all the Arsenal fans were just ripping us. I just thought, I mean, I don't think Iwobi's that bad, but it's obvious we've had our pants down there. And again, it's a sign that maybe that sort of, you know, big spending culture that Mashiri's brought, maybe he's still not really hell-bent on letting go of that just yet. He seems to always want to put his hand in his pocket, which, fair play, as an ambitious owner, that's great, but obviously there's financial constraints that we've got to work with, and certainly in the summer of 2017, we didn't do that.
I think Corbyn came into the club at an unfortunate time for him, because it was a fairly new structure, bringing in Steve Walsh as the director of football. It was the first time we'd had money in, you know, how many years, since like the 1980s. I mean, like, it was ridiculous, really. And I think it was an unfortunate time. And I think if he came in now with the structure we've got now, obviously he won't be coming in now, but if he had come in at this point, we've got more security now, more self-brand, is more, you know, careful with his money, I think he would have been a lot better. But that kind of, you know, free firing, we've got money, we've got a director of football, let's buy whoever, I don't think that was really good timing for a fairly decent manager, to be fair.
It's worth remembering as well that Steve Walsh was only a chief scout. He wasn't actually a director of football, so he was probably out of his depth. And I think the lasting legacy of Steve Walsh will be his briefcase jaunt in Northern Italy, where I don't know what he'd done. I don't know what he had in the briefcase, but clearly it
didn't. He linked with like 8 players, wasn't he?
Yeah.
We're going to come back with like 8 of Inter Milan and AC Milan players, and that was the most exciting rumour ever.
Yeah, and we came back with nothing.
probably for the best, because we're letting him off with two of his worst signings, Schneiderlin and Bolasie.
Oh, yeah, we haven't even got on to the ones that happened before that. I mean, Schneiderlin's... They're both still here. And Blassie is here now because he's had his loan cancelled.
Hasn't he, yeah.
My God, it really was. I mean, I was talking to my mate about this last night, funnily enough, about, like, do you remember people talk about clubs and banter eras? This was the height of it. Obviously, that summer of them, like, We buy everyone, we think we're going to do bits, and then we just have the most depressing season going. Obviously, we'll have to finish off by looking into the early stages of that season and what got Coombe in the sack. At what point did you decide, I'll go through the 3 years here, when did you decide that enough was enough with Ronald Koeman?
I'll jump in then first, if you don't mind.
It's
difficult. It's difficult, isn't it? Because obviously he didn't start that season well at all. But I remember sitting at Old Trafford fairly early on when Lukaku scored in the 4-0 win, and Valencia scored a pair after about 4 minutes. And we had a couple of chances in that first half, Rooney and Sigurdsson, with the two sort of who missed the chances. But I think even at that point early on, as I say, I'm as patient as they come. But I sat there just wondering what he was actually doing, and, you know, the formation of the side, the players that he was picking. Again, it goes back to the transfer window and trying to sort of shoehorn players into a formation, and it was never going to work. So even that early on, against, you know, for me, an average United side, they weren't going to pull up any kind of trees, and that for me, and that was disappointing. But obviously, as the time went on, obviously the Arsenal game was a killer, wasn't it? The 5-2, you know, Williams fighting the fella coming down the street with his kid and stuff like that. That was sort of the highlight of the Koeman, or the end of the Koeman reign for me. And it sort of that pissed my whole sort of 17-18 start of the season.
It was a difficult start of the season. You know, we reeled off some of the names there. We had like most of the top six in the first like 2 months. Do you ever think that was that sort of got held against them a bit? Do you think he was harshly treated in that respect, or did he have to go?
Sorry, mate. I know what you're saying, because we had similar, obviously, with Silva as well in terms of who we're playing. I think with Koeman, he had that season before and did fairly well, didn't he? And you just thought we were going to kick on. And like, you can go back to the transfer window. That was the massive sort of nail in his coffin almost, and like we just said, he wasn't sort of the whole reason to blame for the whole thing. Steve Walsh, Ken Light, Machia, you want to put a portion of blame too. But I thought we would have kicked on, and given, you know, the Arsenal game, the 5-2 at home, even, you know, win against Arsenal side, give them more of a game, and we didn't do, as I say, United away, be more competitive, and we weren't. So as much as we were playing sort of top six sides, for me, he still should have done that a little bit better.
I think it was a bad start of fixtures, to be fair. But was it that Burnley 1-0? Was it that season when,
oh,
you know, it was kind of in the middle of it all? And, like, obviously, you can't blame him for, you know, losing the games that he lost against the top six. But that Burnley game, it was just hopeless. I think everyone understood at that point. I think the problem stretched further than, oh, we've just played some good sides. That Burnley side was absolutely nothing. It was 1-0 at Goodison with a Jeff Hendrick goal. I mean, that was awful.
Well, I think at that point, we all knew. We stood there and made them look like Barcelona, and no one put a tackle in.
I think at that point we knew that was it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it came sooner than any of those ones that you've said. It was the game before United. It was when we got beat 3-0 off Atalanta. It was when I made my mind up. I think I just remember we looked an absolute mess. Completely disjointed. And obviously, it only went on to get worse. Like you say, like the Burnley game was probably the worst of it. Even though it was the Arsenal game that sealed his fate, the Burnley ones are the one I remember where it was really, really dour. And there just didn't seem to be any hope. Teddy, do you want to give your word on it before we finish up on Koeman?
Yeah, well, what was the question? When did we decide?
When did you decide you'd had enough of Koeman?
I never did. I honestly agree with everything you're saying. It was terrible. The Atalanta game, you know, the Burnley game, awful, awful performances, awful results. But I didn't blame Koeman as much as everyone else did. I'm not saying he did well or anything, but I genuinely felt that given the same run of events that happened for Unsworth and Allardyce, we would have just done the same thing. I think if Koeman would have got to January and bought even the same players, Walcott and Tosin, I think we'd have done exactly the same that we did do and just won a few more agreeable home fixtures and made better use of having Walcott in the team and Bolasie, a bit of pace. And I don't think we would have been that much worse off. I'm not saying it was good, but I remember thinking at the time, there's no manager's going to come in and suddenly make, you know, these players fast, or Ashley Williams, you know, not an idiot, and so on and so forth. So I never did, you know, think Koeman's got to go, it's Koeman's fault. I didn't really argue against it when it did happen, because it was a bit hard too at that point. But if I'd have been in charge, I would have stuck with him, just given the circumstances around it.
So a different answer from everyone there. That's an interesting one. I think it's fitting really that it should be me who comes up first, the one who's got the least patience. just before we finish, we'll have to touch on one thing that came to light after Koeman left, and that's the story about, I think, when Graham Sharp gave him a book on Everton's history and he threw it in the bin. Are you aware of that?
I've never heard of that, no.
I'm sure one of the Everton ambassadors, like a club icon like Sharp or Graeme Stewart or somebody, gave him a book on to read about Everton's history and he threw it in the bin.
Not great if it's true, but I've never heard that personally.
I'm gonna have to do a bit of research here. I'm sure I might be making something up here. I'm pretty sure it happened.
I mean, maybe it did, but it's one of those things you could probably do if you're winning. If we win this derby, Ancelotti could set fire to a book like that if he wanted to. But if you're not winning, you can't do that.
God knows, I can't find anything. So I'll have to look into that. I might have made that up in my head there, but I mean, I'll be honest, I'm a bit of a Koeman detractor, so that sounds about right that I'd make something like that up. But I'm honestly convinced that I heard that somewhere. But yeah, there you go. I'm not sure how much truth there was in that, but it was a disappointing season anyway, the way it got off to that sort of start. I think that defeat against Arsenal left us about 17th.
So we dropped us to the bottom three, I think, didn't we, after that game?
Bottom three.
Sure we did.
But so obviously, that as soon as Everton go into the bottom three, there's instantly a lot of anxiety. I think people who've been scarred by the 90s. Like, thankfully, I'm not one of them. I don't think any of us are we?
I am. I know I don't look it. I know I don't look like my age and all that. I look about 23, but you know, I was there for both Wimbledon and Coventry. But that's it's a fear factor, isn't it? Once you start floating around there, that happened obviously to sort of Marco Silva as well. It happens, doesn't it? And you don't want to be, and we shouldn't be anywhere near those positions. So once we start sort of getting sort of the bottom four or five, then yeah, the manager unfortunately will always be looked at.
Yeah, obviously that happened, and we just have to finish off by asking, what would you say Ronald Koeman's legacy is at Everton?
I'll go in first.
Wait, mate.
I think most people thought, I mean, out of the past, you know, couple of managers, you know, we've been through a few in the past few years. I think he's. I don't want to make any bold accusations here, but I think people are warmed more to him than people like Marco Silva. Marco Silva never looked really like he had a clue what he was doing when we went down, you know, this season. But with Koeman, you still kind of believe in them a bit, as Terry was saying, like he never really gave up on him. So I think out of the past few, people are more endeared towards Koeman, apart from obviously the red Christmas tree. But I mean, it still wasn't ideal. And I don't think anyone's asking for him back anytime soon. But I don't think out of everyone that we've had in the past couple of years, he's the absolute worst.
Terry?
For me, his legacy will just be when he came into the club, saw that a left back was number 8 and he went absolutely nuts and took it off him to Ross Barkley. I think the lasting legacy of him will be that picture of him on the touchline where he looked like Phil Mitchell. It's like that's what they got to do him. When we first saw him, he was in his villa in Spain drinking a Corona, having a great time. He'd just been announced as the manager and he wasn't even like here, like, you know, not a care in the world. And then when it was almost time to go, he was on the touchline at Goodison Park. I think, what was the game?
It was the Lyon game in Europe. Yeah.
And he looked absolutely like a corpse, didn't he? He was like a bloated ginger corpse.
That's a classic. What about you, Mike?
He's a little bit of a sort of bluff for me, Koeman. It seems really strange, as I said. Like when he was first touted to coming in, and when he signed the contract, I thought, you know, fantastic. What a player he was. Let's hope he can kick on as a manager with us. And it's just, you know, that first season was decent. It was almost expected for me because with the side that we had, I always thought, yeah, we should be knocking down top seven. You know, make no mistake. The side outside the usual top six, you know, we should have been top of them. So the way that it panned out, it's a little bit of a blot, I think, on the Everton managerial landscape. But like we've said, was he to blame 100%? Of course he wasn't. You know, that transfer window will always be the thing that we look back on and think, if we could have done something different during the Koeman era, could it have been different going forward? We would have got that window right. Could he have kicked on with the management style that he's got? You know, you look at him with the Dutch national side, and they have progressed under Ronald Koeman. I know they've got a decent talent pop, but they have progressed compared to where they were. So could he have taken us forward? But yeah, it's a shame with Koeman because, as I say, he did bring a bit of excitement. But unfortunately, I rate him higher than Sam Allardyce,
obviously,
which might be well. In some people's eyes, some people love Allardyce. I don't know, you know. I don't know why, but he's a little bit of a bluff for me.
They're not welcome here anyway, if they are.
I think this is a unanimous decision that there's no Sam Allardyce approval in this show.
It's a shame you couldn't have done the Sam Allardyce here.
We did that one a couple of weeks ago, so if you're watching, check that one out as well, because that's obviously a little bit, that's very fiery. But yeah, for me, I think Ronald Koeman, his legacy for me is the amount of mistakes that were made. Obviously, like Mike just said, not necessarily his fault, but a lot of mistakes were made, and mistakes that, sadly, the legacy is the mistakes that we're still paying the price for, players who are still on the books who we can't shift. And that'll always be what I remember, unfortunately, like that era of bringing in too many players on too much money, and we've still got a couple more years to shift them all out. So unfortunately, again, I'm with Mike there, a bit of a blot, but, you know, there was good memories as well. So there you have it, guys. That's the end of the Koeman review. Let us know what you thought of Ronald Koeman's time at Everton. He was, obviously, he was a bit of a divisive figure, as you can tell from this show. We're going to be deciding whether or not Kurt Zouma should be worth re-signing for Everton in the next transfer window. Of course, a new centre-back is still on the agenda for the summer, but is Zouma the answer? We'll start with you, Thomas, this time. Are you surprised we haven't heard more links to Kurt Zouma, given how much we chased them last summer?
Well, I think in terms of rumour, it's more of a cheap one for kind of news outlets to come out with, because obviously he was a former loan player, and it's an easy one to put out there. But I think that maybe rumours died down more because Lampard genuinely seems to have no interest in selling them whatsoever. You know, sometimes when you have loan players that go back to the parent clubs, managers aren't like as clear whether they're going to keep them or not, but Lampard never seemed like he was going to sell them. And I doubt he will now, to be fair, because he seems happy with them in defence, and, you know, they've got more worries elsewhere. But in terms of centre-backs, I just doubt Zouma's ever going to come, really. It's disappointing as much as it is. I was more hopeful last year. I think before Lampard took over, there was a lot more rumours. But now, I can't see it happening, really. And I think if it was going to happen, we'd have to spend two watching him. And I think we'd be making a video in a couple of years' time talking about how much we overspent on Kurt Zouma.
Yeah, I think, well, the reason I ended up bringing up this topic was the Daily Star said that Chelsea would be open to selling him this summer and that he's fallen out of favour, which I know the Daily Star is not usually noted for its accuracy and integrity, but, you know, this is a... It's like you say, it's a bit of a cheap rumour, but is there any sort of substance behind that? Do you think Chelsea would consider selling him? Teddy, what do you think?
I definitely think they'd consider selling him, but not for cheap. Like, they, you know, they're not... just because he may be surplus to requirements now doesn't mean Chelsea suddenly becomes stupid overnight. He's still, you know, a decent player who could command a decent fee. And I think at the minute, unless we were... you know, very, very outside, I wouldn't imagine this would happen. But unless we were to get him on loan again with a view to buy this time, with a, you know, a buy option included, then I can't see it, you know, being possible. And now, you know, you might go, well, why would they loan us him again if we've already had him? I think only because of the effects of COVID-19, you know, like the funky sort of finance, you know, transfers that we're probably going to see as a result of that. You know, you're going to see loans or two-year loans or swap deals more than you'd ever saw before in the Premier League. I do think Zouma's a good player. I wouldn't be upset if we did, you know, go back for him, but I wouldn't be super excited too, because I'm a believer in not going back outside of very, very, you know, rare circumstances. But how often do players go back to clubs they've already been at, even if it's just on loan, and then they live up to the previous standards, or if they weren't, you know, successful the first time, how often do they go back to clubs they've been at and they're even better? I couldn't see Zouma coming in and being any better than he was when he was first here. And as, you know, consistent as he was, did he really kick us on to that next level? Did he really, you know, rip up trees? I'd rather spend the type of money that it'd take to get Zouma on someone who could potentially be a little bit better than Zouma.
Obviously, that the big thing that we have to take into account as well is that when we were pursuing Kurt Zouma last summer, Marco Silva was the manager, and now we have Carlo Ancelotti, who might not rate Kurt Zouma for all we know. But what sort of influence can Ancelotti have on this situation? Like, obviously, he might have a different idea of what he wants to play at centre-back. And we have been linked to a few different names. And do you think that maybe puts an end to the Kurt Zouma possibilities?
Yeah, I'd imagine so. Just because how often do you see, you know, do you see players who are linked with a club under one manager, but then ends up, you know, still going there after, you know, when a new manager comes in? United don't get linked with players who they were linked with under Mourinho anymore, do they? You know, like, and I'd be amazed if we were, you know, still interested in players who were Marco Silva targets. Carlo Ancelotti will have his own targets and his own, you know, style of play. And I think if we were interested in Zouma, it would have come out before now, because it is just a link that went away. And frankly, and I don't mean this in a sort of like, oh, well, you know, screw him kind of way. But he knocked us back last summer when we were after him all summer. So I think it's just right for the club to move on to different targets, because he clearly, if he wants to come now, his attitude isn't right, because he didn't want to come in the first place. So it would just be a case of we're like a consolation prize because he couldn't make it at Chelsea.
No, I think that's a really good point as well. I think we don't really want, and I understand that those sides are above us in the league, but you don't really want sloppy seconds off the top six. Mike, what do you think?
I was always a massive Kurt Zouma fan. Obviously, you know, people forget he wasn't consistent in that first probably half of last season when he was obviously with us, and then he was starting more often and sort of cemented his place in the side, and you know that's when he really, really kicked on. You know, he was forming decent partnerships. There was a trust there between him and Jordan Pickford as well, which is obviously really important. The time to get Kurt Zouma was obviously the summer when Marco Silva, like Terry's just said, it was a Marco Silva sign, and he liked them. He wanted them. Obviously, he got knocked back for whatever reason. I know we went up to the last day of the window between him and Tomori, and Everton were convinced that either Zouma or Tomori would be allowed to come on loan. It didn't happen because of obviously Chelsea's transfer ban. People forget now Chelsea, even sort of post COVID-19 situation financially, are in a very, very good position. Because they haven't spent so you know they got that Ziyech from Ajax, Timo Werner, that's also done as well.
Chilwell,
you
know, as well, they're after now.
Apparently so, for big money as well. So even though obviously the majority of clubs are really going to be hammered by this, they won't be as much. So like Terry said again, they're in such a strong position. But again, you know, Thomas mentioned on it's such a lazy link really at the moment. Ancelotti's will have identified his own targets. We know we need a centre half. The papers can put two and two together and get seven. It's quite easy, really. But you know, we've heard about Gabriel, Tadebo, the lad. You know, there's two there who would be ahead of Kurt Zouma, I'm sure, in the Ancelotti pecking.
Definitely. But yeah. So on the note of Kurt Zouma, just before we finish on this topic, dead in the water, do you think?
Yeah. I reckon so, yeah.
I think it's a remnant of the Marco Silva era that maybe we just need to move forward from. He was a likeable figure, wasn't he? But, you know, it's a different era, and obviously Carlo Ancelotti has different targets, and I think we can leave it at that, to be honest with Kurt Zouma, and I don't think there's much more to say on what hasn't been said about Kurt Zouma. I mean, we pretty much covered him relentlessly for the whole of last summer, and it never ended up getting him. And we've got to move forward. And Carlo Ancelotti's definitely got something else in mind. I mean, this is like the only rumour we've heard about Kurt Zouma for, 9-10 months now. So, yeah, I think I'd definitely say it's dead in the water as well. Obviously, on this note, guys, we'll leave it at that. But if you have any ideas of centre-back alternatives, let us know. Just let us know any ideas you've got who could maybe become the new centre-back, who Carlo might have in mind. Or let us know whether you think Kurt Zouma coming back might be a good idea. For you podcast listeners, now it's time for the middle bit, where we give ourselves a much-needed break from talking about Everton and we discuss something else. Going to keep with the topic of films we've been going with the last couple of weeks. We're going to ask each other today, what is the most overrated film? I know, Teddy, you're into your films, so we'll get your opinion first. Teddy, what would you say? What's the most overrated film?
I'd have to say Avatar. And I don't mean Avatar The Last Airbender. I mean like the Avatar with the blue people. Don't see why it's so big and so popular. Like, I know there's, you know, highest grossing film is not really a barometer of how good a film is, but every time you see, you know, as any YouTube, you know, show watchers will know, I'm a big fan of the Marvel, you know, universe films. And whenever, you know, one of their big efforts, like the big Avengers films, like gets close to the highest grossing film ever, it's always Avatar that it's trying to beat. And I think Avengers Endgame did beat it recently. But I've seen Avatar and I just think, how is this the highest grossing film ever? Like, it's just, the dialogue's terrible in it. It's so, like, cheesy. And, you know, there's worse films than it, but not, you know, like, there's no, not films.
But they're not making millions popular, at the box office.
Yeah, like, you know, Titanic's up there is one of the biggest films ever. But it's like, you know, Titanic's not a bad film, you know what I mean?
Right,
if it's not your cup of tea, it's not your cup of tea. But you couldn't sit there and go, this is crap, you know, like, it doesn't make, why do people like this? Avatar, I don't get it, though. It's like, I don't know any sci-fi fans who think it's great. I don't know any, you know, like, you know, because it's got romantic aspect to it. I don't know any, like, you know, romance film, like, people, you know, buffs who like it. It's just, it's like U2 as a band. You never meet a U2 fan, but they're one of the biggest bands in the world. I bet one of you is a U2 fan now. But
well, we'll get to that point where, like, in about 10 years' time, where, like, you know, James Cameron's lost the plot and he's, like, downloading films onto people's iPods for free.
Yeah, so Avatar for me, it's not an egregious offender, but I just think, why is this the, well, until very recently, why is this the biggest grossing film ever? It's got nothing like about it that makes it worthwhile. I don't know. I mean, I remember it coming out, and a big gimmick was it was the beginning of 3D films. So I always chalked it up to that. But yeah, that's my submission.
Well, that's a good job because you took mine away from me there as well, because that's exactly what I just said as well. Mike, what about you, mate?
I'm not a big film watcher, I'll be totally honest with you. So I could sit here and rip to pieces every single film that's ever been made because I don't particularly enjoy them. I can't stand Avengers Infinity War. What's behind you on the wall there? I'm joking.
Nobody told me before you came on.
I've watched many films over the years, but a lot of people are really into films and I'm just not, you know, I can't watch Star Wars, you know, all the Star Wars don't do anything for me at all. The Harry Potter films, no, nothing for me. The Matrix, all like, you know, it's just not my kind of thing. I'd rather sit there and watch sport documentaries, to be perfectly honest, and watch actual things that have happened. The only thing which you watch is probably fake, it's probably Corrie. I could sit here and talk about Corrie all day if you want and critique my favourite characters over the years.
We'll have to remember after the next time we get you on. That'll be our middle bit then.
You know, there's a bit of a Bill Kenwright link there for you as well, obviously.
Bill Kenwright in there crying in the pub to Teresa.
That's right. But no, films just isn't my thing. And, you know, as I say, I could sit here and moan all day about films, but I won't. I won't bore you with it, to be honest.
Fair enough, mate. Fair enough. Thomas, what about you, mate?
Well, I don't really watch many films the same, but films I never really understood why so like, people were so excited about 1917 and Dunkirk. I didn't like them. I thought they were a bit boring, to be fair. I mean, it was clever in 1917 with the whole, you know, it's all in one shot, he's moving through the place. I just found it a bit boring, and it was the same with Dunkirk. Dunkirk seemed a bit gimmicky to me. I mean, it's not gimmicky. I just didn't enjoy them, and I get a lot of people did, and they were, you know, renowned for their techniques or whatever, but I'm not a big like film critic. I couldn't tell you much about, you know, the different techniques used, but I just found them quite boring, really. And obviously, was it Dunkirk, which didn't have like any music in it either? I just got quite bored of watching it in the end. And it just, obviously, Harry Styles is in it, so that kind of brought the standard down, you know, a few notches just naturally. And then 1917 was better, but still a bit boring, really. The CGI actually in 1917 wasn't bad, but I didn't enjoy them as films.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those. I'm not huge on that kind of genre of film, so I think that's never going to appeal to me. But I was still surprised to see how well it did. So I can kind of understand why you put that as overrated. And there you have it, guys. That's our opinions on the most overrated films. It's Mike spoiled as ballot paper, if you like. And, Thomas has gone with 1917, and then, like I say, me and Terry seem to agree on something. Avatar. Who said? You know, we can't agree on everything. Right. Well, anyway, we'll move on to our next topic. We are back with a season performance review for Theo Walcott this time, probably one of the more divisive players in the Everton squad. Certainly one of the more divisive players over the course of his career as well. So certainly going to be interesting to see what kind of debate we can sort of bring up in this one. We'll start with you on this one, Mike. What do you think about Walcott's performances this season? What do you mean?
It's such a frustrating watch at times, Walcott, because, you know, football nowadays, especially attacking players, is all pace and power, isn't it? You know, and Theo Walcott, you know, he's very, very quick across the ground. But he's so frustrating, you know, 25 games, one goal, Theo Walcott. And we all know, obviously, that when the goal was and the time of the goal was absolutely fantastic and what a moment it was. But he's one of those, I think with Walcott, again, this season, I just think he's trusted as a senior player to do his job. You know, defensively, I don't think he particularly goes missing. He'll always track back in a sense, you know, but when he's, you know, his bread and butter is going forward and trying to create chances and bring players in and use his pace and get in behind the, you know, the fullbacks, etc. And he just doesn't do it consistently enough. And it's such a shame with him because when he was brought in, he had a half decent introduction to the side. You know, we got brought in by Allardyce, thought he did okay. And thought he would kick on, starting week in, week out for us. I thought, you know, we'd start to see the best of Walcott and potentially, you know, he'd be getting back amongst the England squad. But again, this season, he promises a lot of times, he really does, but he frustrates so much, he misses chances. And, you know, his final ball, yet again, it's just so hit and miss, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's been an issue for Theo Walcott for as long as I've been watching him, like, since he was, like, what, 18, 17, when he first burst onto the scene with Arsenal. It was, again, I was expecting to see him kick on even before he came to Everton, and he didn't. So that was kind of made me a bit sceptical about how he could, like, have an impact at Everton. What about you, Teddy? What do you think about the impact Walcott's had this season?
Walcott's had his Walcott season, hasn't he? The season he has every single year when he was at Arsenal. And he'll have like a spell of games where he's electric, pick up an injury, and then he'll just be anonymous for all the other games. Like, he was going to get injured against Crystal Palace.
Yeah, Crystal Palace
against 3-1. He'd been playing some of his best football I was ever.
Yeah, he got boss crossing for Bernard and then got injured like 2 minutes later.
Yeah, and that you know, encapsulated his whole career, really. He's always been like that, hasn't he? If he was consistent, you know, he'd be world class almost, but he's just not. He has games where he's unplayable. He's really fast, he's really direct. He's not the type of player who you know, gets the ball and takes on a man, but he pops up in, you know, in good positions. He gets amongst the action, but he is finishing. There's a video compilation made of last season where Sigurdsson could have had about 15 assists if Walcott could finish. And it's just the amount of times Walcott just fluffs his lines, and that's the way he's been again this season. He's found a new lease of life, I think, under Ancelotti. I thought this 4-4-2 would be the death of Walcott at Everton, but he's actually took to it quite well. You know, that sort of, you know, sort of simplified right-hand side position, but he's sort of seen as the, well, that position in general, and him being the only natural fit there, especially Walcott. But it's like the third attacker, isn't it? Like, the left-hand side sort of cuts in and does like an inverted number 10 position, so Bernardo, Wobi, Sigurdsson sometimes, goes on that left and, you know, sort of floats centrally, whereas the right-hand side midfielder stays wide but goes more direct, goes more forward. You see it perfectly in that goal he scores against Watford. Like, the three, you know, there's Richarlison, Keane at that point, or it would have been Calvert-Lewin earlier in the match, and then Walcott as the three-pronged attack. But he doesn't contribute enough goals to justify being the first pick there. He's definitely worth having an in and around the squad still, I think. But you'd hope, you know, whatever we are able to do transfer-wise in the summer, I would hope that we'd get a player for that position, because we need someone in that role who can chip in with more goals than Walcott does, because he's a good player, but he's too hot and cold. He'll always do this. He'll always have like decent runs of form, followed by an injury, and then followed by a long stretch of just, you know, floating through games. And it's just the way that's Theo Walcott. He was like that when we bought him, and he's still like that.
Well, and let's not forget that he is into his 30s now. He's 31 now, isn't he? I mean, usually for wingers who rely on the pace, it's not it's usually a bit of a death knell when you get to your early 30s. You know, I do think we need to look, and I think we discussed this in the transfer show we did the other week, didn't we? We said that right wing was a crucial position to strengthen for that reason. And that might just signal the end is coming for Theo Walcott, as certainly as a starter in the Everton team.
Well, one thing, I mean, hopefully we're never in such a position to have to do it, but you never know, especially with these games coming up, you know, all squashed together. I'd be almost interested to see how Walcott would do in this 4-4-2 as a striker, in that sort of, you know, second striker off Calvert-Lewin, the role Richarlison plays. Now, he's obviously not a patch on Richarlison, but he's always wanted to be a striker in his career, and he's never played in a team until now who plays 4-4-2. So I wonder whether he'd be any good there. Like, you know, as I said, if he's playing in there, it means you've got an injury and you don't want that. But I wonder if you'd get a little second wind out of him if he played there, because he's been crying his whole career to be played there, and you know, he's never going to get a better chance than this, is he?
Certainly an interesting idea. That's not something I thought of for sure, but definitely I would be interested in that. And like you say, I think given the couple of injuries we've got and that, and the fact that the squad's going to be stretched because of the lack of match fitness, it could be something we're trying out. And no doubt Carlo Ancelotti.
I mean, you never know. Probably might not happen. Probably won't. But I'd be interested if it ever did.
But no doubt Carlo Ancelotti, given the way he was sort of rotating the squad anyway before the lockdown, I think it wouldn't be surprised to see him experiment a little bit. So it might be something we get to see. Thomas, what about you, mate? What do you make of Walcott?
I think he's reaching a dangerous point in his career now where he's going to be too old to be a regular starter. But, you know, when you get to that age, you need to be seen as reliable. You know, if there's an injury, you need to step in, you know, kind of like Leighton Baines plays now. But Walcott's problem is he's not reliable if he starts, he's not reliable if he doesn't start. So he's kind of at the dangerous point in his career now where if he can't be relied upon, you know, to not play every game, but just kind of fill in for injuries, and he can't be relied upon to start, he doesn't really have a place in the squad at all. And he does have his, you know, he does have his on games, but he just has so many more off games where he just misplaces passes that you don't expect him to. His final ball's awful. And I think definitely now there's less excuse for kind of, oh, let's see what happens, you know, when he kind of hits his, you know, the peak of his career, because, you know, I think he said he was 31 now.
He's past the peak of anything. He's past it completely now.
And I just don't think, I think he's an all right player every now and then, but I don't think we can really afford to have a player like that. And he's probably on one of the highest wages at the club, knowing him. You know, he came from Arsenal. And I just don't think he's worth having around the club, to be fair. That sounds harsh, to be fair. It sounds like I'm just trying to throw him out. But he doesn't offer what Leighton Baines does, as kind of like one of the most senior players I have on. And he obviously doesn't offer anything as like a regular starter. So I don't really see where he fits into the squad at all anymore.
I think that's the more damning indictment out of anybody there.
Yeah, I feel like I've been a bit harsh
The prime Walcott detractor here, clearly. But,
I like him as a person. He actually seems like a sound bloke.
He does, actually. Yeah, I'll agree with that. But obviously, it's been a pretty stop-start season, and there's not a lot to report on from Walcott, apart from the obvious limbs at Watford away. So we'll leave it at that. We'll do our scores out of 10. What would you give out of 10? Mike, what would you give Walcott out of 10 for this season?
Oh, I probably couldn't give more than a 5 or 6, to be honest with you. Again, even a 31, he promises a lot. And like Thomas has said there, doesn't really deliver.
Yeah, what would you give then? A 5, a 6?
I'll be nice. I'll go 6. I'll be nice.
6. What about you, Teddy?
Going to give him a 5. He's not had a great season, but he's not had he's given us some decent moments as well, like, you know, the limbs at Watford and the peach of a cross for Bernard, that boosts him a little bit. But yeah, 5.
What about you, Thomas?
I can't see myself giving him more than a 5, to be fair, but I was going to give him a 4, but to be fair, bringing up that Watford goal, you know, we can have another couple of seasons just for that in my eyes. So I'll give him a 5, that'll do.
I'd have gone with a 5 as well. So you got 3 5s and a 6 there. So, no, it's the kind of average score of general inconsistency that you'd expect from a Theo Walcott. I think, like you said, I think, Teddy, you said it yourself, didn't you? That it's a typical Theo Walcott season. And
you watch know, any the... episodes of Arsenal Fan TV, and it'll be the exact same. Whenever he gets mentioned, it's the same thing.
Well, there you go. Well, you know, we'll look ahead to the 2021 season, and we can rinse and repeat this next year, then, can't we?
Yeah.
So there you have it, guys. That's the end of the Walcott discussion, if you like. Let us know how you think Walcott has done this season. We've got the final main segment now, which will be a brief discussion on the new sponsorship deal. Everton have announced a new sponsorship deal with Cazoo. Cazoo is an online used car dealership and is a relatively new yet successful business venture. Started up in 2018 by the founder of online estate agent Zoopla, among other things. The deal is reportedly $10 million a year, which is only a slight improvement on the $9.2 million a year deal we were getting off Sport Pesa. And this deal that we've signed with Cazoo runs for 3 years, which will take us up to what is expected to be the final season that we play at Goodison. So, lads, what do you think of the new deal? Mike, what about you first?
The first I heard of them was the S put up, didn't he, a few weeks ago, mentioned Cazoo and got laughed at a little bit, to be honest with you, because there's all this talk over Usmanov and USM and Megafon and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, people have got to realise, I think, in the current financial climate, it's very, very difficult. A lot of companies are taking massive hits in terms of revenue and income, et cetera. But this has been going on for obviously a little while as well, because Hummel is saying that the shares are going to be getting released in the next couple of weeks. So this sponsor's not just come out of anywhere, you know, just out of the blue. But looking at one thing that I had to look at, obviously, from a club point of view, it's finances. Okay, so that's Everton's side. As a fan, I like to look at, okay, how does it look on a kit? So I threw a kit out earlier, and I was like to just mess around with designs, etc. Dead basic. With their logo on, you know, Hummel with the chevrons, an old Everton badge, and it looks, you know, V-neck shirt, and it looks clean, it looks smart. More importantly, kids can get a shirt with the sponsor on. And that's the first time, is it, since we had Chiang, wasn't it, since Chiang came on board, which is a massive, massive thing, I think, for the commercial aspect or in terms of share sales, etc., because kids like to obviously feel a big part of it. I know when I used to buy shirts for my daughter, she gets ladies' shirts now, but, you know, even then, you'd think they look so much better with that sponsor on. And I'm sure it puts certain people off. So for me, I'm quite happy with it. Listen, let the club sort the finances and what have you. I look at how does it look on the shirt. Can the kids get it? Yeah, that's great. That'll do for me.
Really well put, to be honest, mate. And Thomas, what about you? What do you think of the Cazoo deal? Do you think it's a good move by the club?
Yeah, to be fair, obviously, what Mike said there about finances, that's all the club's business. We can never really, you know, talk too much about that. I think, just to try to say something different there, because Mike pretty much covered it all, but just to say, it seems like definitely a company that's kind of going to grow, and obviously the board are constantly looking for, you know, expansion, growth, going to Bramley Moor. Because obviously people were talking about the owner of the company did Zoopla, didn't he, and Love Film, stuff like that. So they clearly believe in the company, because everyone was laughing this morning, because obviously everyone's got more followers than them on Twitter, so everyone was having a good laugh about that. But it seems like they've got potential to, you know, kind of grow as a company. And clearly that's what the board are after, you know, someone who can grow with the club and obviously kind of make the transition into Bramley Moor whenever we end up there now. Obviously about the kid shirts, I mean, it hits close to home for me. I don't think I've only had a couple of shirts now with the actual sponsors on, obviously. But it's good to have it, yeah. In terms of the finances, I was a bit disappointed that it's similar to Sport Pesa. And I get the club are kind of trying to take this moral high ground about betting sponsors and not having them, even though there's no official ruling on it yet. But, you know, it is what it is. We can't change it now. It looks all right. Obviously, it's not going to be red. It's not going to be hideous. I don't really mind. It seems like a good deal overall.
I think the most important thing I think you just touched on is that it's an improvement on Sport Pesa. I think the look on the shirt, I think the whole model side of it. I think obviously you said it's not been banned or anything just yet, but it's certainly a standpoint that Denise Barrett-Baxendale was very outspoken about this, wasn't she? She said that they want to move to they didn't like the contradiction between the fact that Everton and the community were doing a lot to help gambling issues and having a gambling sponsor, which was obviously undermining what they were doing, they thought. And I think this, it's a good move in that respect, certainly from the club's publicity standpoint. What about you, Terry? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, first and foremost, you know, both lads touched on it. The main thing for me, as just as a supporter, is what it looks like. Does the sponsor ruin the kit? And no, it's a nice, simple, you know, clean logo. It's hard to really get that wrong. Like, let's be honest, and it's not quite as, you know, plain as Sport Pezza. Sport Pezza's font was like, didn't even look like a real company, did it? At least because he's got
generic, like aerial black text, I think it was.
yeah, at least Kazoo, you know, varies slightly from that, so it looks like it's an actual company. So yeah, it's how it looks is a big thing, and as long as it's not something like, you know, ridiculous, like, you know, Poundland or something like that, because then you're going to end up with all the footy banter accounts crucifying you. So yeah, so from a design aspect, fine with it. I'm prefer that to Sport Pezza. I am glad that at the club I've gone away from the gambling sponsor for two reasons. One, I think it's just good for the club to get ahead of that anyway, because I think down the line we're going to end up having that enforced on top flight football in the country. It won't be coming in the next few months, obviously, but I think sooner or later that'll be, you know, that'll be a rule that the government will bring in, going, oh, front of shirt sponsors can't be gambling companies. Starting from this year, you can't renew with a gambling company, so you've got to let your contracts run out. So even if that doesn't happen, it's still the right thing to do. The club have, you know, have made the point that with Everton and the community, the work they do with, you know, helping people through addiction, gambling is part of that. They didn't want a gambling, you know, sponsor. It's the right thing to do. But it also made it quite difficult when, you know, you drop your sponsor right as a global pandemic hits, and, you know, the massive, you know, business recession, you know, hits everywhere, the whole world. And you've also boxed yourself in a little bit by saying publicly that you don't want a gambling sponsor. So for us to come out with a comparable deal, given all those, you know, outside influences, basically tying our hands a little bit, I think it's a good thing. Like, I know everyone was like, I'll put Megaphone on it for 500 million. It's like, yeah, other clubs in the Premier League aren't going to let us do that. Let's be real. Like,
they're going to see through that.
You need to advertise, you know, money-wise. I'm not an expert on, you know, finances, but, you know, I can't see it being a bad thing to diversify your income. Like, I know we get a lot of money from the same, you know, source, Mr. Usmanov, you know, is many Mr. Usmanov in disguise, but I'm fine with it. I'm happy with it. I think it's a good choice on behalf of the club, and you touched on it before as well. Very shrewd that we've, much like with Hummel, only signed it for 3 years. So we've basically, we're lining up commercial deals and branding deals, which take us to the end of an era at Everton, which is when we leave Goodison Park, and it could be we go for a full commercial reboot again in 3 years' time, for ideally
with a bigger stadium and a bigger pulling power, maybe. But yeah, that's what the aim is, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, we could go for a reboot with more pull, more, you know, leverage. We could, you know, we're resetting now this summer for the final stretch of Goodison Park. I know that's horrible to contemplate, but we'll do it all again when it's time to move into the next chapter of the club's history. And I think it's very, very clever. You know, it feels very far removed from the days of Robert Elstone, where these deals might have been 6 years and for half the money and so on and so forth. And yeah, I can't find any issues with this deal. I'm pretty pleased with it for what it is.
Yeah, I'll be honest, that's a really good point to finish on there as well. I think how far we've come since Elston was the chief exec, and these sort of deals seem to be being done a lot more professionally and a lot more, like you say, a lot more measured, a lot more calculated. I don't think we seem to ever have a clue what we're doing. And if anything, that's a really good indicator that we're moving in the right direction, is that the people in charge of the financial side of things seem to be in control of what they're doing. And that can only help us, particularly as we head into this sort of period of uncertainty as well.
Yeah, it just shows joins up thinking that these deals are structured in a way that, you know, when the new stadium opens, we've got an opportunity to go with different brands for everything and sell them something a little bit more, you know, a little bit more high quality. You know, new stadium, hopefully a better team, everything. But I think considering all the outside influences, you know, the depressed, you know, financial market, the fact that we've ruled out a massive part of the advertising sector in football from our own, you know, our own comments, I think we've done really well to get a deal as good as that. I know people want them to be a much bigger deal, but I think if we could have had a deal worth twice this lined up, it probably would have disappeared with the outbreak of the virus. What can you do? Like, the real world happens. Like, well, it's not unique to football, but I think we could have it a lot worse. I think this is a good move by the club.
Yeah, and obviously, I think, like you say, Cazoo's quite a new company. It's going to grow, and it wants to grow mutually, I think, with the club, which is going to be a really good thing. And just a final little comment here. Alex Chesterman, the guy who founded Cazoo, he lobbied to try and stop Brexit as well. So I'm sure that'll go down well with your typical Scouser as well. So
he wanted it, the deal, reviewed by Parliament, didn't he? I remember hearing about that. So, yeah, he's the right kind of guy.
Clearly they're going down the moral route, certainly. They've got the club's showing off its... I mean, that's always been the way. Everton's always been a club that tries to do the right thing, and it seems that we've finally found a sponsor in that respect. That's a much better match for us than the previous one, which is another step in the right direction.
Yeah, and it's an indicator that the club listen to the supporters. You know, one, I mean...
Definitely.
You know, whether you agree or not, a very large, you know, voice, you know, large amounts of supporters have voiced concern about a gambling sponsor. Some people didn't care. Some people
especially a gambling sponsor that's repeatedly took the mickey out of Everton as well. Let's not forget that.
Well, yeah, but some clubs have just turned around and go, listen, money talks, whoever pays the most money is getting it. We've turned around and said, no, we're a club with a very clear identity of who we are and what our supporters want. And when we're taking gambling off the shirt, and I, for one, am happy with that. I like the club that they've done that. Wasn't particularly a big problem for me to have a gambling sponsor, but it shows that they've listened to the supporters, and you can't fault them for that.
Yeah, so I think the club's definitely, in terms of the PR side of things, definitely made a very good move there as well. So we'll leave it at that anyway. That's the end of the sort of kit sponsorship deal discussion. Let us know what you think about the new kit sponsorship deal. Podcast listeners, we're going to finish off with a quiz. It's a bit of a different one this week. It's an international caps challenge. I'm going to give the lads a name of a former Everton player, and they're going to have to guess how many caps they got for their respective countries. Closest one to the right answer out of the three of them gets the point, and the first of 5 points is the winner, who gets to pick the song at the end of the show. Ready, lads? This is the best part. This is the best part of it. I don't
have to.
You'll never be ready. But the best part of this is that I don't have to go looking for a coin to flip, because I just throw names at you and like you just all give me an answer now. So yeah, no coins to flip. We'll just get straight into it. So we'll go with Mike, then Terry, then Thomas.
So you put me last. You know that makes plenty of sense after what's happened in the past.
I've heard you've got a very good track record. Regardless, mate, I think you'll be just fine.
I think Terry has nightmares about it. To be fair, so he was haunted when he heard I was coming on.
Terry's record versus you was almost as bad as ours against Liverpool. So here we go. Right, he's all ready, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. First question: how many caps did Tim Howard have for the USA?
I'm gonna say 83.
So, what about you, Terry?
91.
Thomas, what about you, mate?
I'll go
95. Now it's a kind of like a Price is Right kind of format. Whoever gets the closest by points, sorry, by the amount of caps, is going to get the point. And I can tell you that the number is 93. So Terry and Thomas are getting a point there. So that's a very interesting start. Terry and Thomas both have a point after the first one. Second question, there's 15, by the way, so one way or another, we will find the winner. Even if it takes all night. Second question, how many caps does Seamus Coleman have for the Republic of Ireland?
I'll say 69.
Teddy?
Fifty-two.
Thomas?
I'll just go somewhere in the middle. 59.
This is incredibly close. Seamus Coleman has 56 caps. Thomas, you've got the point, mate. Question number three. How many caps does Johnny Heitinger have for the Netherlands?
47.
Mike, you've gone with 47. Teddy?
'Cause I watched it in a video off another channel. I can't remember. 55.
So we've got Mike with 47, Teddy with 55, and Thomas.
I don't want it to seem like I'm going down the middle every time, but I'll go 50.
50. Well, the answer was a nice round number actually, but it was 40, and Mike's got a point. There you go. Everyone's off the mark. So it's not bad here. This one's going to go to the wire, I think. Question number four. How many caps did James McFadden get for Scotland?
Oh, I'd say 51.
51. What about you, Terry?
Can't be that high.
39. Thomas?
Yeah, I don't think it's that high at all, because I agree with Terry. 36.
We were looking for the number 33. Thomas, you got another point, mate.
Terry's just getting flashbacks now.
Thomas picks the right time not to go down the middle, doesn't he? Right, here's an interesting one. Question number five. How many caps did Joe Max Moore get for the United States?
I don't know who that is. I've literally never heard of him. When did he play?
He's played in 1999 to 2002. He played for Everton.
He was brilliant. Wasn't he?
What's that?
Me and Michael tell you, he was brilliant, wasn't he?
That was unbelievable. He scored like a hat trick once against someone crap, and like everyone thought he was going to be a world beater.
Go on, Mike. That's a difficult one, that. Joe Max Moore. I'll go in 51.
Teddy?
I haven't got a clue, so I'm going to go for 25.
And Thomas?
I mean, I've never even heard his name before. I mean, they say he joined the club when he left the club when I was born. It's a steep one. I don't know. What did Terry say?
Terry said 25.
Don't tell him.
I'll go 24.
Thomas, I'm not even messing, Thomas. You just played an absolute blinder on him there. Joe Max Moore had 22 caps.
He's horrible. He doesn't even know, and he's still doing it. The Liverpool of the quiz. That's all he is. He's the
devil's quiz participant.
Yeah,
just kept going off everyone else's answers and just guessing.
Horrible.
Okay. Question number six. How many caps does Yakubu have for Nigeria?
49.
Teddy?
I thought 49 sounds right. That's horrible. it worked for you, so I'm going to go with 48.
Thomas.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting, because I was actually always going to go for 47, so I'll go with that.
So unless he's actually off 48 exactly, you couldn't write this,
could you? And the bad thing is, this tactics won Thomas the whole quiz, because Yakubu only had, Yakubu only got 24 caps for Nigeria, and Thomas has won 5-1-1.
I thought I'd only won 4.
That's horrible. That.
We only needed 6 questions. I thought that was going to go to the wire at one point.
He's the living embodiment of those goals on FIFA where you pass it when the keeper's rushed. You know, those scum goals where you just pass it back to the player in the middle, he's the living, the embodiment of that feeling.
He's the embodiment of winning quizzes on this show, though, to be fair to him. Yeah, he's done it. He's gone and done it again.
And
you know what that means? You get to pick the song which sees us out at the end of the podcast. Thomas, what are you going to go with, mate? Tell us a bit about the song.
That's my problem, because obviously I know I'm going to win every time when I come on, but
I know he always comes prepared now.
He's run out of songs. He's picked every song he's ever heard at this point.
I can't even remember what I picked in the past now.
He's going on to hymns from when he was in school now.
I'm still in school. I haven't left yet. Have I done True Faith by New Order yet? I feel like I've said that, but I'll have it again anyway.
I don't know, it's a good song. Do you want to tell us a bit about the song, why you've got to pick it?
It was in my library when I just scrolled down there. I just think it's a bit of a tune. I don't have anything to say.
It's a bit of a tune. I'm not going to argue that it is a bit of a tune.
Terry always seems to have like a storyline to songs that he picks, and then I come on and
I think you run out of stories for the songs that you pick once you you start winning as many quizzes as you do, mate.
I know. I have to make stories, because I get a long time between picks that I have to think about it. I get weeks and weeks and weeks to think about it, mate.
That's it. You know, he comes up with a song like, you know, every now and then when he's lying awake in bed thinking like, why on earth have I never won a quiz against Thomas?
But I think it was my problem. Yeah, I think I wiped out like all the Northeast anthems like quite early on, so now I've got nothing else to say.
Have you done Gaz's version of Fuck on the Tarn yet, where he raps about sickly sausage rolls?
I've never seen that. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that tune, to be fair. That's more, you know, the other side of the river, but maybe one day.
You never know. Well, there you go, we'll end on that. New Order, True Faith is going to see us out. Big thank you to Mike for joining us from An Old Eternity, and if you haven't followed them already, give them a follow as well, because it is a brilliant podcast, and we'll definitely have you on again, Mike, and we'll make sure we talk about Corey instead of films next time. So,
and I was going to have the Corey theme tune to play as out, I would have won that, which is a bit of a shame here,
there you go. Yeah.
I don't like films, I don't like music, I just like everything.
I only like soap opera.
I've only got room for the two. Ken writes on both of them.
if Ken writes on a party, he doesn't want to know.
Exactly right. I love West End plays as well.
Oh, there you go, yeah. Yeah, well, it'll definitely end up being like Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat if he wins the next quiz, innit? We have a brilliant, it was great to have you on the show as well, mate, so we'll definitely have you back soon.
Cheers, mate, enjoy the...
It's right. And, of course, a big thank you to Thomas and Terry, who, of course, you know very well on this show, and their rivalry will keep on going in the quiz, it seems, so...
Is there a rivalry if there's no competition, or is it just, you know...
Oh, he's one of them Liverpool fans who's saying, like, that he's irrelevant now.
Yeah, he replies to Paul Joyce tweets and everything, doesn't he?
This isn't Liverpool. this isn't quiz news, Paul.
It's the worst possible comparison I think I could have picked up on this podcast ever.
You know, this is what happens. This is the cost of success, mate. But there you have it, guys. That's the end of the show. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll finish off with New Order, True Fate. See you later.